Hello, Professor Voss, and welcome to everybody to this World Health Organization teleclass. We have the company of Professor Andreas Voss with us this afternoon, who's going to speak with us. Professor Voss is the head of infection control at the Canisius Wilhelmina Hospital and at the University Medical Center in St. Radboud in the Netherlands. He is the co-organizer and the founder of ICPIC, that had their inaugural meeting in Geneva earlier this year. He's also the editor-in-chief of a new BMC journal, which is called Antimicrobial Resistance and Infection Control. Andreas did his medical training specializing in clinical microbiology in Munich, in Germany. He did his first PhD in Germany on antibiotic prophylaxis in gynecology, and his second PhD in the Netherlands on the epidemiology of cancer. So I believe that makes you a treble doctor, Professor Voss. His PubMed count is more than 150. He's written numerous national and international guidelines. His scientific interest, as you can see from his publication record, is in the epidemiology and control of nosocomial infections, with a particular emphasis on Staphylococcus aureus. And that's what we're here to talk about this afternoon. So I will hand over to Professor Voss to speak with us on MRSA. Is search and destroy the way to go?
Thank you very much for the introduction, and hello to everyone. If I sound funny and the whole thing is strange, this is the first teleclass I ever give, so I apologize if I do extremely rude or senseless things. But I'll try to do my best, and if everything is well, you do have a handout in front of you or can at least see it with three slides a page, and I will go slide by slide and call out the page numbers and the slide numbers to go for that. So what I will be trying to talk about today is MRSA, the background of MRSA, what is search and destroy, because that is what it's all about, the Dutch policy, decolonization of MRSA carriers, and I will talk about some recent literature from the U.S. just to bring it to a perspective and see what was out there. And then if you look at slide three on the first page, you can see what I call when sweet things turn sour, when something goes from a Mars chocolate bar to an MRSA. So this is the topic of today's class. On page two, slide number four on the top, you'll see why MRSA is important for us and that it all has to do with the resistance, which is coded by a change PVP2. And obviously this resistance is the reason why we have to take care of MRSA. It's the intrinsic resistance against penicillins, cephalosporins, and carbapenems. So if you think about back into your empirical treatment within your own hospital, you know while a Staph aureus infection that is resistant to the three classes of antibiotics might be or is a problem. On top of that, while it's called methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, many actually called it just multi-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, because frequently the change PVP is also combined with other resistance, like the resistance against clindamycin and erythromycin. And then as a reminder, think about treating patients with bone and joint infections where you really need clindamycin as one of the few anti-staphylococcal drugs with great penetration that can be given orally. The same thing more or less holds true for ciprofloxacin, that is frequently resistant, or rifampicin, which you cannot even treat patients after total hip replacement with infections or others. Again, another group frequently resistant are aminoglycosides or mupirocin resistance, and the last one is important when we talk about decolonizing patients with MRSA. So this is the resistance side, but more importantly, I believe that we can say that wherever MRSA is highly prevalent, we have more infections. And by that, I mean that it's not a replacement of medicine-susceptible isolates or pathogens causing infection, but that in addition to these infections caused by medicine-susceptible Staphylococcus aureus, MRSA is adding to the problem. We do know that there are old studies and meta-analysis showing that MRSA patients have an about two times higher attributable mortality, so due to the fact that they have MRSA over MSSA, sorry, and there are many papers showing that MRSA infections are associated with higher costs. So, let's go back to the basics. This is the resistance features, the infections and mortality features, but what it states and what people kind of tend to forget, MRSA is in Staphylococcus aureus, and in my talks are usually depicted as a golden cocker, so I'll frequently use a goldfish to give a picture of it. So MRSA stays in first place Staphylococcus aureus. And then when you go to slide 7 on page 3 of the handout, you'll just see a few of those infections that obviously are caused by Staph aureus you're well aware of, from Panaricium to Impetigo, endocarditis, osteomyelitis, pneumonia. The problem with MRSA is it's causing from skin and soft tissues infections in the community to fatal disease like pneumonia and endocarditis in the hospital. There's a wide variety of infections that can be caused by Staphylococcus aureus. So the combination of such a true pathogen with all the resistance and virulence factors mentioned in the first slide makes MRSA really the one organism we should better control. And so in picture 8, you see my picture of MRSA, the same goldfish, just in a more violent kind of form with the shark fin on top. And with a little picture of the hospital symbol, I want to say that classically, as of 1961, when MRSA was first described, until, let's say, the end of the 90s, MRSA used to be a hospital pathogen, cause of nosocomial infections and nothing else. If we then look into Europe, as seen on that slide number 9, you can see there's a very large variation among the prevalence of MRSA. And in this case, we are talking about data from the EARS program, now called EARSnet, and with ECDC. But you can clearly see that there in the northern part of Europe, there is a problem with MRSA. It's lots lower, and then especially in Scandinavia and the Netherlands, whereas in the southern part of Europe, MRSA is highly prevalent. And so there are differences between countries, and the differences in part ignore the fact that countries like the Netherlands can be sharing a border with a country like Belgium that has a pretty high prevalence, and also with Germany where it's higher, but not as high as in Belgium. So obviously, different strategies employed in the different European countries are more or less successful. And it's not only the strategy, it also might be, but we might come to that in the discussion or later on, when you actually started such a strategy. On page 4, you may see that there's more about MRSA. We not only have the strains that are associated with hospitals, but we also have those that are from the community. So what I tried to pick in that the goldfish is out of the bowl, that should be the new community-associated MRSA. But that is not enough. There is another species, again, different from these kinds of strains, the so-called livestock-associated MRSA. And I believe that we cannot talk about the prevention of MRSA without mentioning all the different types that are there. So in page 11, I was trying to mention a few of those. So the classical eMRSA, or epidemic MRSA strains, as the UK named their first strains, and you probably know the eMRSA 15, as one of the really well-known and more prevalent healthcare-associated MRSA isolates. Then you have the healthcare-associated MRSA and all variants like community onset healthcare-associated. Healthcare-associated MRSA, the CA MRSA, the LR MRSA, and then an MRSA which I refer to as the DCHYC1JTMHTGRE-MRSA, which means nothing else that I don't care how you call it, just tell me how to get rid of it, MRSA. In the end, I believe that what we will experience over a few years in our hospital, and we can see these trends clearly at the present time already, that we have a huge mixture of all different types of MRSA within our hospital population and within the community. So in the end, all that we need to know is how to take care of all of them. Until it is that far, we can still describe and try to differentiate between those types. So I wanted to have a few slides on community-associated MRSA only. And if you turn to page 5, slide number 13, there you can see a screenshot from an MMWR paper on 4 pediatric deaths from community-acquired medicine-resistant Staphylococcus aureus in Minnesota and North Dakota. And these were actually the first cases of community-associated MRSA that were described in the literature. And as you can see, they were lethal right away. If you look at the risk groups for this kind of MRSA, it consisted of Aboriginals, Native Americans, prison inmates, sauna visitors, sport teams, homosexual men, military recruits, and kindergarten kids. And the last one, obviously, is extremely amazing that you have such a mixed group of people, but I think what they all have in common is that there is the physical nearness, that it's frequently in crowded places, and that there might be exchanges of toilet articles and other things. And you will know that there are like famous outbreaks among U.S. sports teams who were sharing towels. So that is an easy way of bringing MRSA over. As you can already see, and this is what I alluded to before, and in slide 15 is a screenshot of that, there already is description of transmission of community-associated MRSA in the hospital, in this case, in the Los Angeles system. So with sick children coming to your hospital harboring community-associated MRSA, obviously there always is a chance for nosocomial transmission later on. In slide number 16 on page 6, I have a conclusion slide telling you the most important things about community-associated MRSA. So it's a new type, a new different genotype that are independent from those of healthcare-associated MRSA. They do have different virulence factors that may make sure that they cause severe skin and soft tissue infections or necrotizing pneumonia, and so they are more virulent than the classical healthcare-associated MRSA. You see them more frequently in healthy young patients without typical risk factors. Healthcare-associated MRSA is mainly the elderly patient, the patient with a multitude of underlying disease, whereas community-associated MRSA, as I said, is in the young and previously healthy one. They are now emerging as nosocomial pathogens, and most certainly, community-associated MRSA is a challenge to countries presently using the search-and-destroy strategy to prevent MRSA, since you cannot predict who is at risk of being an MRSA carrier. In slide 17, I repeated the risk groups for community-associated MRSA because I said there's another group added to it, and that's the last one of the animal lovers. And all that has to do with a publication of my own group here in Nijmegen, who showed that actually pig farmers are at risk of carrying MRSA that originated from their pigs. And while in 2004 the average prevalence of MRSA in the Netherlands was in the open community was 0.03%, those pig farmers had a prevalence of 23%, and 2 years later of 50% that were MRSA positive. And nowadays, we know groups of farmers who are up to 80% carriers of this livestock-associated MRSA, as it is called today. The livestock associated MRSA, and that's also depicted in slide number 19 on page 7, is also called ST398, which has to do with the fact that you need MLST typing or SPA typing over the classical variation of pulse field gel electrophoresis to recognize and characterize this isolate, because they do not work with the classical enzymes you use in pulse field gel electrophoresis. So who is at risk of carrying ST398 MRSA? It's all persons in direct contact with pigs and calves. So farmers, they help any person actually coming into the stable and having contact with the animals, which includes obviously veterinarians, animal transport personnel, and slaughterhouse personnel, where it's amazing to see that only those in contact with living animals are the ones who get colonized with MRSA, whereas those slaughterhouse workers working with the meat are not at risk. So direct contact with living pigs and veal calves as a risk factor to be colonized with ST398. What do we have on facts about these? That is, they are a global problem. They are less transmissible than healthcare-associated MRSA. That's a study from the Netherlands that showed that about one-third of the transmission than the usual healthcare-associated MRSA. But on the other hand, they are broadly and permanently present, which is why we suddenly see many cases in my country. They are assumed to be less virulent than healthcare-associated MRSA, but I believe that we have to get rid of that assumption, seen some very recent and some still in press publications. They used to be very susceptible strains, so there were many resistant to methicillin and to tetracycline, which probably helped in selecting them, since that group of antibiotics is given in pigs. But nowadays we see multi-drug-resistant ST398. Some of them, and in some cases, we already see PVL-positive ST398. The first outbreaks by now, I have to say, has been reported with this livestock-associated isolate. And the first cases where the patient in question had an ST398 infection but absolutely no contact with any animal husbandry at all, or any person who might be a known carrier of it. So there might be an indication for the first spread into the community. So I did all this as a prelude to talk about search and destroy and the prevention of MRSA, because I believe you have to be aware of the different sources of MRSA. And in my last slide on page 7, slide number 21, I'm trying to depict that, yes, there might be a future for even more many new friends in the world of MRSA you're going to meet. So let's turn to the prevention part and to search and destroy. On page 8 we start. What is search and destroy? Actually, search and destroy was first described by John Spicer, who is by origin from Australia, and who used and looked into the old UK military literature on strategies of how to prevent things. And search and destroy, obviously, as the name already suggests, is the typical military strategy. And we are using that in the Dutch system. And we're using that to avoid introduction of MRSA into the healthcare settings and to reduce the chance of transmission. We fight MRSA not only with this search and destroy strategy, which we obviously have. It's a national strategy which is part of what we call the WIP, which is the Working Party of Infection Prevention, who does all our infection control protocols in the Netherlands. And you can actually look them up on the website www.wip.nl, and all our infection control protocols are online, free of charge, and most of them are also translated into English for you to read. So you will find also the MRSA guideline, which my talk is based on that website. But we not only have a national guideline for how to take care of MRSA, We also have a national guideline on how to detect MRSA, because it's very, very tough to control problems you don't see. And we have another national guideline on the fast and reliable, and there's a mistake in this slide. It's not the fast and reliable method to detect them, but to decolonize patients. So we have the diagnostic, the prevention, and the treatment part is all regulated in different national guidelines. Please turn with me to page 9, slide number 25, where I try to lay out the key elements of the Dutch MRSA guidelines. What we do is we isolate and screen every single patient at admission who is at risk to be carrying MRSA. Consequently, we do that at all times, and we do so for all patients, even if we suspect them only to be colonized and not infected. We decolonize known carriers so they are no longer part of the transmission chain. We are extremely consequent in our actions when transmission occurs. So we do screening of all patients and healthcare workers at risk when we had an unexpected occurrence of MRSA in a hospital ward. And we do possibly do not allow MRSA positive healthcare workers to work in patient care. So that is the basic key elements of the Dutch MRSA guideline. Isolate at the moment they come to the problem, to the hospital, sorry. Screen them at the same time, and we could talk about what ways of screening there is, from rapid screening with PCR methods, so you don't have to have real isolation. You could screen them in the outpatient department, and then according to the result, isolate them or not. Or you use chrome agars, which is the most commonly used screening method in my country, so you have a result after 18 hours on the next day, which is nearly as reliable as the PCR if you look to sensitivity and specificity, but of course far cheaper than using molecular methods. So isolation, screening, decolonization, and consequent actions, and especially the last one, because we hear from a lot of countries who try to employ the same kind of guidelines, but with the exception of weekends where they are too busy, or in certain wards where they don't have enough isolation rooms. So we try to do so in 100% of all the cases. What exactly do we do to patients that go into isolation? In the Netherlands, MRSA patients, or those suspected to be MRSA, are placed in isolation rooms. That means with an anteroom, with negative pressure. We know that that is not an absolute need. We'll do it since we have the circumstances in our hospital structure to do so, but we know from the Scandinavian countries that they frequently place their patients in single rooms only, and I believe that the single room, apart from every other patient, is the most important part of it. If you have an isolation room, that might be even better, but there is no hard data for that. We furthermore use gloves, gowns, and face masks for everyone entering the room for anything they do. So it's what we call strict isolation with regard to MRSA. Again, I can say here that in other successful countries like in Scandinavia, they are not always using a face mask, since we know the face mask is there not to prevent the aerogenic spread, but to prevent your own contaminated fingers to touch your nares and thereby become colonized. So for as long as your healthcare workers can leave their fingers out of their nares, the face mask has no or little added value. And most importantly, and I believe no one could be able to give a WHO teleclass without mentioning the word hand hygiene, but obviously there are tons of papers showing how important good hand hygiene is to prevent the transmission of MRSA. So it sounds like little to do, but actually if you have a high prevalence of MRSA, then we talk about many patients that need to be screened and isolated. So there's difference between what other people do. And that's what I'm trying to depict in my slide number 27. Isolation and screening of patients on admission is a problem for some people because they can't determine who are the patients at risk. They only do it in certain departments. They don't do it in busy weekends. They only pick out infected patients, whereas it's pretty logical to me that if you have a patient with an MRSA septicemia, where MRSA is kind of condemned to the bloodstream, will spread less MRSA than a patient who's colonized in his respiratory tract and is being, like, on an intensive care unit and being regularly suctioned. Obviously, this patient, the last patient, is only colonized but will transmit much more MRSA than someone who is infected. There are also countries who do not decolonize MRSA carriers who believe once they're out of my view, they are no part of the transmission anymore. And then there are countries for a long, long time, U.S. guidelines, excluded healthcare workers from being screened in outbreak situations and in normal situations around MRSA. So consequently, MRSA-positive healthcare workers may continue to spread MRSA. So my belief is that if other countries were less successful, despite saying that they are following a kind of search and destroy principle as the Dutch do, then it's mainly due to the fact that they do so very inconsequently. And on my slide 28, I'm trying to depict that when we fight MRSA, we are extremely consequent, and you know, maybe you've seen a sign like that with no trespassing, violators will be shot. The Dutch go a step further, they go for survivors will be shot again. But does that actually mean that the Dutch way is the only way that works to control MRSA? And obviously there's huge discussions about it, and there are only a very, very few countries around the world who are in our situation that were lucky enough to start early with the introduction of MRSA, which I forgot to tell you that we started Search and Destroy in 1986 after the first cases of MRSA were imported from with tourists that came back after an aircraft accident in Portugal who got MRSA in Portugal and then were dispersed to several hospitals within the Netherlands and with the as a consequence having multiple outbreaks of MRSA. So as early as 1986, after just being introduced into our hospitals, we have this national guideline on search and destroy. And I believe that most of you will not be in that lucky situation of having such a low rate of MRSA. Say, okay, but how could we do that with as many as MRSA as we have? And actually, this is the nice thing about coming back to the ears data. If you look in slide 30, you see the classical ears data where the South European countries, Southern European countries still have the high prevalence between 25 and 50 or sometimes even more percent of MRSA. And we talk about MRSA as part of all Staphylococcus aureus isolates from blood cultures. But more important than where are you now is where are you actually going? What is the trend? And in most countries, that's very easy, because in most countries, or many countries, the trend is increasing. I now pick the example of France, but I could have easily picked also the example of the UK, which are the two countries where there were major national efforts to decrease MRSA. And who have been, as you can see from slide number 32, where the color of France changed from, yeah, in the black and white you can see that, but it was bright, but it was red, and it's going to orange, which means it's now a prevalence between 10 and 20%. How did the French people achieve that? And you can see that in slide 33, which was a courtesy of Monsignor Jalier, who gave it to me, where they started to fight MRSA in 1994 and or at the end of 1993, which accidentally was due to the first publication on MRSA prevalence in MRSA where the French were, I wouldn't say accused, were just depicted as one of the highest prevalence countries of MRSA in Europe. And within their pride, they thought, this is not what we want. And I'm very, very glad that they took that measurement, at least within the Paris area. Over the years, they reduced MRSA, and the highest impact was obviously with the alcohol-based hand rub campaign, but they also introduced a sort of search and destroy. What they exactly did is depicted in slide 34 on top of page 12. They took isolation as an intervention, so they actually started isolating colonized and infected patients. They promoted the hand hygiene. They tried to identify MRSA, colonized and infected patients, also screening for MRSA. They gave feedback of their MRSA rates in a kind of real-life situation. So they didn't wait for a year and told you last year you had. So they tried to do that frequently and accurately from recent data. They also produced annual reports. And so I believe what I'm trying to say with all this, it's not that you have to follow the Dutch guideline word by word, but that you have to pick the major components to actually drive the MRSA prevalence down. So screening, isolation, and good hand hygiene as the major factor of controlling MRSA. That despite this fact you can be in trouble is something you can see in slide 35, where there is the MRSA prevalence in Denmark, and you can see there is a steep increase, at least, of one of those lines, namely the line for community-associated MRSA. So even if you use search and destroy, you are dependent on the fact that you have an idea of your local epidemiology, which patients are at risk for MRSA, because those are the patients you not only want to screen, but preferably also isolate on admission, if still needed. So my conclusion from this would be that the battle against healthcare-associated MRSA seems, and then maybe I should add, in principle, very, very easy, but if you look on slide 37 on page 13, that the control of community-associated and livestock-associated MRSA, or I should better say the emergence of these types of MRSA, is and poses a real challenge to the strategies we presently use. Then again, is the strategy all you need? I believe if you want to fight MRSA as well as all other highly resistant microorganisms within your healthcare setting, you need more than just a good strategy. Other factors count too, like the compliance with basic infection control measures of your healthcare workers, the infrastructure of your hospital. I mean, it's very tough to isolate patients if you don't even have single rooms. The healthcare worker-patient ratio, and not to make you jealous, but in most intensive care units in the Netherlands, it's 1-to-1, at least at daytime, and in the general wards, it's between 1-to-3, 1-to-4, and I know countries which have 1-to-7, 1-to-10, and higher. So obviously, if you have so much work to do, it's very, very tough to live infection control in the fullest as we do. So it is important that you do have a good infrastructure in your hospital and a good healthcare worker patient ratio. We also believe in good antibiotic control and cooperation of all the healthcare sectors. So we try to make sure that our infection control planning is not only for the hospital, but also influences how patients in nursing homes or in the first line of care will be treated. And last but not least, unfortunately, we have very, very little influence of that, but I believe it is a strong determinant for antimicrobial resistance and the spread of resistant microorganisms. We probably will have to have a look into farming and food, because this will have an influence of the occurrence of these microorganisms. So this is all I wanted to say about search and destroy in general, but there's obviously part of search and destroy is the decolonization of mainly nasal, but not carriers in the nares, but also in their throat and on their skin, MRSA carriers. So now a few slides on decolonization. If you look into decolonization, and I apologize if that screenshot is really bad to see and most certainly on the copy, I just wanted to mention that there is a good publication from the Dutch system, and that is actually a publication of the Dutch, in part of the Dutch national guideline in the Journal of Antimicrobial Chemotherapy in June 2011. It was published ahead of print, so you should be able to see it soon. I didn't look it up again. And you can see that we made a difference between uncomplicated carriers of MRSA and complicated carriers of MRSA. Complicated carriers being those who had been treated before and were still positive, so failed initial treatment, or those that are colonized in the throat only. Amazingly enough, that seems to be a risk factor. And there are a few more, but we won't be going through all the slides of decolonization. And just to give you an idea how to do that, in slide 41, you can see that there's a flow chart for uncomplicated and complicated carriers of MRSA and how to treat them. And just to let you know, we mainly believe in topical treatment with mupirocine and chlorhexidine on the skin and mupirocine in the nares. And if that isn't enough, we add the systemic orally given antibiotics to it. We describe the standard infection control measures you would describe for anyone with repetitive Staphylococcus aureus infection. We also, in complicated cases, look into household members, which can go as far as the cat or the dog of someone, because there are enough cases showing that in those people you weren't able to decolonize, pets might be a permanent source of MRSA in the household. So let's round this up with decolonization. And what happens if you do that? In the only topical treatment, we are successful in more than 60% of all the MRSA carriers, and overall, I believe that at the present time, there are only a very few cases of healthcare workers and patients we weren't able to decolonize, given the fact that they have no more tubes in them and a good skin condition. So from them with eczema, you will not be able to decolonize unless you treat eczema first. The risk factors for decolonization failure in this study were COPD, throat and perineum carriage among household contacts, and throat carriage and dependency in activity of daily living in the complicated cases. So, but have a look at that article. Try to have a look at it and see how to decolonize patients just in case you don't have a national policy. So why is it might it be important to look in the household members? This is what I tried to depict in the transmission of MRSA to household contacts in slide 33, 44, and 45. What you can see from, again, a Dutch study published in Journal of Clinical Micro 2010, that if you had 62 newly diagnosed index persons with MRSA and looked into their 160 household contacts, in nearly 50% of all cases, someone who is a carrier of MRSA will transmit MRSA to his or her family members. So it's a high chance that if you only treat the index case, and that one in two family members at home will be positive, stay positive, and have the chance to reintroduce carriership to other members. If you looked into the risk factors of transmission of MRSA in a household, it was prolonged exposure time to MRSA at home, being the partner of an MRSA index, increased number of household contact, and amazing enough, younger age, so younger people between 25 and 45, had a higher chance to be positive as someone who's a little bit more than slightly above 45. I would think everything above is out, still young, but you can discuss that. MRSA indexed with eczema, and I already mentioned that these are very, very hard to decolonize, and MRSA colonization in the throat. And amazingly enough, wounds had no influence on how successful you were with decolonizing a patient. So the conclusion from that paper was depicted in slide 46. If you screen a household contact, you have to provide MRSA eradication to all those found positively simultaneously. So this is for all those who would like to decolonize well. Then my last slides of today will be on the literature. And in 48, I depicted the two boxers saying Huskin versus Jane. These are two articles from the U.S. on MRSA and on the sense of MRSA screening, which are two very different outcomes. The first is the article of Huskins in New England Journal that intervention to reduce transmission of resistant bacteria in intensive care units. Their aim, as stated in slide 50, was to have an effect of surveillance for MRSA and VRE colonization and of expanded use of barrier precaution as an intervention as compared with existing practice. So what did they actually do? They kind of created, they wanted to have two groups, namely a control group as depicted in slide 51 and an intervention group for all those known to have MRSA and for the purpose of study also VRE. And the ones in the control group came into standard precautions, and you can have a look what that meant with regard to hand hygiene, glove use, and gown use. And those who were known to be carriers had contact precautions. And again, all the measurements are depicted in that third column. And then for all those patients who were unidentified and where they didn't know yet what to do, they had an intervention unknown group where there was extensive glove use. You could call it universal gloving, but not gown use. What is the result of this study from Haskin and colleagues? Namely, that the mean incidence in ICUs for MRSA and MRSA and VIE did not differ significantly between the intervention and the control group. So, with other words, this is like the authors telling us that doing all the intervention, doing good infection control and isolation and screening does not work. The problem is in the comments I have on that how many patients of the control group underwent expanded contact precaution because they had clinical samples with highly resistant microorganisms, so they actually had the same. And the other part is that it took on average, if you go through the methods of the study, probably 5 to 6 days before the full contact precautions were actually applied to patients because it took them too long to identify MRSA and VIE. And we do not know if other preventive measures were applied and to which extent. We do know that the hand hygiene compliance was relatively poorly in that institution, so that will have add to that too. In the end, Huskins and Al shares a study where fighting MRSA does not seem to work. Then Jane and colleagues published in the Veterans Affairs Initiative to Prevent Medicine-Resistant Staphylococcus aureus Infections. And if you look at their methods, as I depicted them in slide 55 on page 19, they used an MRSA bundle that was implemented in 2007 in all acute care VA hospitals nationwide. The bundle consisted of universal nasal surveillance of MRSA, contact precautions for patients colonized or infected with MRSA, good hand hygiene, and a change in the institutional culture. And the last one is this, the question is, what is that? But they say the changes whereby infection control would become a responsibility of everyone who had contact with patients. If you look at the results slide, or the first results slide, number 56, They did nearly 1.8 million PCRs, which is a fortune in PCRs, and a lot of work, obviously, in the over the whole period of the study. And if you look at the compliance with this method of screening patients on admission, it was very, very high in the beginning, but it was 82% in the beginning, but it even increased to 96% and stayed there for the time of the study period. So a really good compliance within those settings with a new strategy. If we look at the result slides, the second result slide, slide number 57, the rate of MRSA transmission in the ICU was reduced by 17% in the ICUs and by 21% in the non-ICUs. So here is an enormous success of the strategy to control MRSA next to the transmission that was so reduced by 70 to 21%. The MRSA rate of healthcare-associated infection declined from 1.64 to 0.62 per 1,000 patient days, which equals a decrease of 62%. In slide 58, you can just look at that later on again, just showing you the different healthcare-associated infections and the reduction of MRSA over the years of the study in ICU and non-ICU patients, and over the line, of all patients in and outside the ICU and all sort of healthcare-associated infections, MRSA was decreased. So if I look at both papers together, Huskin versus Jane, there's a kind of culture screening in Huskin versus PCR, and that has a lot to do with the capture rate. If you would calculate how many of the patients were captured in time to actually apply the isolation measures in the full-blown version of it, then Huskins would have only captured 40% of the patient, whereas Jane and colleagues certainly reached more than 80%. So optimal treatment, optimal preventive measures could be applied early on. I do have one question with the paper of Jane, because the interventions they used in their studies, screening, contact precaution, and culture change, have effect of transmission of MRSA. And with a relatively low reduction of transmission, 17 to 20%, they achieved a very high reduction of healthcare-associated infections of above 60%. So my main question is, were there other concurrent interventions in the culture change part that I described? Was there something else that worked? But in the end, I really couldn't care less, because what I believe what's happening in these studies is that and that Jane and I'll certainly show that if you bundle activities against MRSA, if you have commitment from your CEOs and from a regional or national system that is supporting your event, it will work 1,000 times better than just trying it on yourself. So in my opinion, looking at Huskin versus Jane, most certainly, and that's shown in slide 62, and thereby also my last slide. In any case, I believe that the patients in the Jane paper are the winner of this all, and I couldn't care less if that is because the bundle works or because one part of the bundle worked or the culture change worked, as long as we all find working matters to reduce MRSA, I believe that that would be a very good case. Last slide on your handout is just the date of the Taylor class series, which is actually only one to follow on December 7th. And by this, I would like to return to the convener of this Taylor class. And let's say again, I don't know if it would be possible to have questions, but otherwise try to get in contact via email if there are any more for questions. And thank you very much for your attention.
Professor Voss, thank you very much. This is John Otter from London. I'm hosting the class today. Unfortunately, we won't be able to open the line for questions, but if you do have a question, please feel free to email. You can contact Andreas via Paul Weber at paul@webertraining.com. Now, Andreas, we do have a few moments left, so I thought I may take the liberty of asking a few questions myself, which hopefully some of the audience may relate to. Firstly, I was very taken by the image of the matador being hit up into the air by the bull, which was representing community-associated or livestock-associated MRSA, and the matador had the sign saying search and destroy in his hands. So do you think that, search and destroy is feasible in a community setting?
Yeah, I mean, this really is very hard to give a clear answer to that. As you can see from the data I included from Robert Skoff in Denmark, slide number 35, just a few slides before the Matador paper, it clearly shows that, yes, they had a problem with community-associated MRSA. I believe that by now they got rid of that problem by starting to better know the risk factors even for patients in community-associated MRSA. So once you have better epidemiological data to kind of predict who are the patients in your region to be in trouble with community-associated MRSA, then it's no problem. As a moment, a risk group I know, I can easily introduce into my screening, and that won't be the problem. The problem, on the other hand, is, and that is the unpredictable part, we have introduced reduction of community-associated MRSA 10 years ago, nearly two, so very, very early on, single families. But we don't see it further. We don't see it spread. We don't see it back in the hospital and spreading in that hospital there. So it is a danger, because if you have community spread you don't know about, you will consequently have hospital spread later on. So it is a danger to surgery. I wouldn't say that the battle is lost. As you know, some of those matadors survived these kind of attacks and were still able to fight the bulls. But they certainly do so after being harmed.
Right. So would you recommend healthcare workers that have a case of a patient with a community clone following that patient up, going into their homes, screening their contacts in the home, to try and prevent community spread and subsequent readmission to the hospital?
Yeah, that's an extremely good question. I believe they should. I know that it's very. Everyone will start out saying this is impossible to. You can't do that. Why? Because a lot of people, we only taking care of infection control in the hospital, and we don't care about nursing homes or primary care. It's exactly what I said in the class. We should change that system. We do need to cooperate. We do need to take. I'll try to coach GPs to tell them how to take care of MRSA patients. And even better, we, like in my hospital and many hospitals in the Netherlands by now, have that. We have an MRSA polyclinic that will help to decolonize any patient you want to decolonize. If you look into, there's a fantastic initiative, it's called Your Safety Health Net, an initiative of the EU regions, the border regions in Europe. In this case, between the Dutch and German border, there you can see they developed a special transmission form that the hospital gives to wherever the patient is going, telling them, this is an MRSA patient, this is what you should do. If you can do it on yourself, contact some experts in the area, contact a polyclinic like ours to get the patient decolonized. If we increase the number of patients with MRSA, even if it's community MRSA, especially if it's community MRSA, where we don't see how much it's spreading, we will be in a bigger problem to win the fight against MRSA.
Right. Okay. Changing tack slightly, there's some controversy in the UK and the USA at the moment about how best to perform screening on admission to hospital. Some people are saying we need to screen everybody, every single person that comes into our hospital. Other people are saying screen nobody. Some people are saying screen people on a risk basis. So what would be your answer to that?
Yeah, I would say that the principles of search and destroy is on risk basis. Screening everyone. The problem is when you don't know what's my risk. So in a lot of these projects, they start out in screening everyone just to get a good picture from where are my sources of MRSA. But it would be crazy to continue a philosophy like that to screen everyone. The whole idea behind that could only be to know what is my source of MRSA. Because if you're living in Belgium, you know, or then you could know if you have done the screening, that there's a high prevalence of MRSA in nursing home patients. So when you have a nursing home patient coming, yes, they should be screened. As you know from your screening and epidemiology research, you have a low prevalence in children, a low prevalence in geriatric patients, et cetera. Why continue to screen groups that are not at risk? I believe that it's important for the local and the regional epidemiology, but once you are certain of having that, and I think many countries like ours have national reference centers who furthermore look at the blood culture isolates and then all isolates of MRSA in the Netherlands, Scandinavia, to see where they come from, you have data to act on. The problem is having no data, not knowing your epidemiology. So I would say no screening won't help because you can't take all the measurements for everyone. That's impossible. I would always start with a broad screening, but I would always try to reduce it to a payable amount on top. We also talk about a lot of money you have to invest, certainly if you do use rapid screening.
Okay, well, lots more questions I could ask, but unfortunately we have run out of time. So I'd like to just repeat my thanks to you, Andreas, today for your excellent teleclass. Reiterate the fact that if you have any questions, please email paul@webertraining.com, who will forward on your message to Andreas. And with that, I will conclude this class. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. Bye.